Yo, so you're here on the Black Creative Left podcast with Tobias Olajuwon. We're trying something different today. We're going to go Facebook Live as well and see if we can get some more interaction and deal with some real-time questions. So what I'm thinking about today is the complexity for Black, queer, and Black queer folks that are poor Black folks in general, the complexity about how we go about choosing, how do we go about choosing a presidential candidate in this Democratic primary this time around. And if we're going to choose anyone at all, right? Because a lot of folks don't believe in voting, and that's something else we can discuss as well. So for those of you that are here on Facebook Live, thank you for being here. Go ahead and drop some questions. We're going to have some interaction going on, but we're going to record the podcast in this new way today. So I see y'all popping in. Hello, hello. Thanks for showing up. So this Democratic primary, right, has introduced a lot of variables and given us a lot of very interesting choices. Those of us that align ourselves as Democrats, those of us that align ourselves as independents, those of us that align ourselves just as Black folks engaged in the politics and the praxis of harm reduction so we can continue the business of living when the election's over. We have a lot of choices here. But as I said earlier, for those of you that follow me on Facebook, we really have a variety of choices that are different flavors or different varieties of a shit sandwich, right? We've got folks like Elizabeth Warren, who has a very interesting but focused economic analysis. But again, someone who engaged in this type of not blackface, perhaps native face, right? Claiming this native ancestry that is dubious at best, but has had a spot on economic analysis, yet one that up until this last election has proved to be colorblind, not inclusive of Black folks, not concerned with people of color, non-Black people of color either, nor queer people, despite having a long background in economic policy and law and bankruptcy law as a professor at Harvard Law, and also creating the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which I worked at for a year in policy and supervision. Then we have newly announced Bernie Sanders, someone who I think has been consistent over the last 20 years, Democratic socialist, which is basic a little bit to the right of a real socialist, really sharp class analysis. The last election was a little shaky on racial justice shit, stumbled around, has a little bit clearer focus this time around. We'll see what the hell he's talking about. But again, old white people, not really clear on social justice, racial justice issues, and the intersections of race and class. We have Kamala Harris, former Attorney General of California, first-term senator from California. Many people have called her and critiqued her as a top cop, as a police officer, as a cop. Fair critiques, I think. She went after a lot of Black people that are poor Black parents for truancy issues. And I think I think that's something that's worth debating, right? Because there is a consequence that goes on when those of us that grew up poor are not brought to school by our parents. That's time we lose. But there's also those of us that are abolitionists that are like, that's not the way we go about policing the behaviors of the Black poor and the Black queer poor. Who else we have? Julian Castro, former HUD secretary, hasn't done really much with his life besides that. A little controversy when he was HUD secretary under Obama. There was several programs laying to Black folks that he let slide. So that definitely needs to be looked into. Kirsten Gillibrand, a white girl from New York. She's been good on white women's issues, I guess. I don't really have much to say about Kirsten Gillibrand. Hold on, I have a question here. So the question is, I have a clear set of things I want to know. One, how does the candidate intend to make reversing? I'm just going to guess what that is because I can't see the whole comment, but I'm guessing you're talking about the reversing of the economic and, you know, racial injustice things that Black and Black queer people deal with. Correct me if I'm wrong, Jamila, but just to finish on the candidate summary. So you have Kirsten Gillibrand, a white girl from New York, not really sure what she's doing besides white women's issues, really kind of like progressive but kind of middle of the road white woman feminism that's going on. We have, so that's Julian Castro, Kamala Harris. Oh, Cory Booker. Cory Booker, Mr. Peace and Love. I think Cory Booker, even though he has a really great policy on these seed grants for black babies, well, I guess all babies in America, that would essentially give them an investment fund, or, you know, that's something that he would invest in every year to kind of close the wealth gap between the rich and the poor, which is a great roundabout way of going about affirmative action and corrective action, as I like to call it, on a racial class way. But Cory Booker, Cory Booker is probably my least, not my least favorite, but I'm very skeptical of Cory Booker because he is a wonderful, beautiful black man, of course, but I'm skeptical of him because he made this comment last week, y'all. He made this comment about getting his PhD in the streets. He comes from a middle-class family, and I remember when he ran for election the first time, he lost. And then he went and he got on food stamps and he lived in the hood for a year and kind of ingratiated himself to the people like he was getting this immersion. Like when you go study abroad and you learn a foreign language. That was like really... And then he couldn't even... He was asked if Trump was a racist and he was like, I don't know what's in his heart. As if like racism and white supremacy is about your heart and not about like materiality. That, I don't know. I don't know about him. So we got a comment from the homie Cam Clark saying, give Julian Castro and his black woman campaign manager some love. Look, I'm not into representational politics. I'm very much about what have you done for me lately? What have you done for me ever? Julian Castro's record on black people is non-existent in San Antonio. It's not a strong mayoral system. And also his work in the Department of HUD, essentially, really did not, there was nothing that stood out about him. He didn't do anything for black people. So for me, like, look, I'm glad there's a Latinx person running, but I want to know what are you saying differently, right? And if you're a person of color, or if you're a non-black person of color or a black person, I feel like you have a duty, and this is just my personal politics. You should be doing more and saying more about racial and economic analysis than the white folks running for election, right? Like, what? There's a serious problem here. When a 76, 77-year-old, I don't know how old Bernie Sanders is, a white Jew, right, from New York, now Vermont, has the most advanced policies for black people. That's a really sad, like, how does that happen? Like, what is going on? It's a comment that says Cory Booker irks her for some reason. And I think the reason is like he's inauthentic, right? Like, look, it's okay to be an upper middle class, light skinned, blue eyed black guy. Like, yo, that's the skin you in, bruh. Roll with it. Be authentic with that shit. You know, own it. And then make these same points if that's what you truly believe. But like, don't tell me that you went to the hood and immersed yourself. Like, this is study abroad. Like, that's... You know, like, people talk about, like, blackface, but for me, that's really trying on black poverty. And I think that that's an issue that we have in the black community, particularly when we're dealing with these middle and upper middle class black folks that like to listen to the music created by black poor people, that engage in the style and the linguistic production, the way black poor people talk, the way we dress, the way we move, and the way we just move through the world, right? And use that as kind of a fashion statement and also like a cultural cachet and proof of blackness. But then when those same black poor people go to these black middle class places, whether it's a barbershop even, whether it's a job interview, or whether, you know, it's just the schoolhouse and those are your teachers or your professors at college, there's a ways in which you begin to be policed and you pay not just a tax for being black, but a tax for being both black and poor. Right, whereas these upper and middle class black people get to take that off and lean in the privilege of their class advantages, right? And particularly when those middle and upper middle class black people don't live in the same impoverished neighborhoods that have particular types of consequences for looking and speaking the way that black poor people look and speak, right? So like it's a really, 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 really strange thing. And it's a kind of like racial class drag that I feel very... very, 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 very uncomfortable with. Because, like, check this out. Like, right? Like, if you gotta grab your bag, or you're gonna move on the bus or train when you see me coming by, why are you wearing what I'm wearing? We might be kin, but we not family, right? And that's not to say that there's a permanent cleavage between Black poor people and Black middle and upper class people. But we do have to be real, I think, as Daryl Baskerville said earlier on Facebook, that oftentimes the Black middle and upper class police the Black lower class, the Black working class, the Black poor, right? And that distance created between the middle and upper class and the Black poor actually situates the Black middle class as an other type of Blackness, like the smart Blacks, the reasonable Blacks, the Blacks you can negotiate with, right? The moderate Blacks. And if we're going to be very serious about this, our most radical, our most loving, our most queer politics have always come from the Black poor undercommons, right? Black people in the hood and Black people in the country that is poor, they have a relationship to bodies and to self that are oftentimes unimaginable. Unimaginable to Black folks in suburbia. That, and this isn't an absolute, I'm not speaking absolutes here, but I'm thinking about the ways in which a lot of Black people in suburbia are trying to maintain stability, which is class privilege, and that's fine. We want everyone to be stable. We want everyone to be able to go home and rest and take a bubble bath, and I also know it's not all peaches and cream there, but in this attempt to hold on to stability, there becomes a differentiation. There becomes a different performance of this other Blackness that marks you as distant from the Black poor, those that are oftentimes lambasted, those that are marked as criminalized. There's work that's done to say, I'm not them. And I don't think it's an intentional anti-poor Black, anti-Black poorness. But what I do think it is an evasion of being targeted, right, by particular types of violent systems and mechanisms, whether it's the police or whether it's being able to move up in your company. So that really disturbs me. But the question I was trying to get at earlier, and those of y'all on Facebook, hopefully I can see your whole message, because it's playing games a little bit. But what I was getting at earlier is, like, how do we really begin to choose and judge our candidates? And as I was looking through the comments online today, I started to see not an absolute break, but a general breaking trend between my friends that have been intergenerational members of the middle class or higher, and my people that have really been broke since forever, ever. Right? Your mama been broke, your grandma been broke, like, we all been broke. Yes, so before we get to that, Kalima says the Black middle class position is also precarious. And it can be lost at any time. I mean, the average Black net worth, I believe, is a negative number. But the average, there's a $70,000 difference between Black people and white people in net worth, right? So even Black middle class people, many of them are one emergency away from being destitute and being Black poor. And I also think that anxiety does a certain thing, and it regulates the ways in which we interact with one another. But what I was trying to ask earlier is trying to figure out, how do we choose these candidates? And this trend I'm seeing is that a lot of my middle-class Black friends, those that have been middle-class for a hot minute, as in like a long-ass time, they seem to be concerned with the person, the character of the candidate. It's almost as if they want a candidate that they believe that they have a closeness to, an affinity to. It's almost like, you know, when the white people used to say, oh, we like George Bush so I can have a beer with him. There seems to be this interest in, like, their authenticity and their character and, like, how they make you feel, and these politics of, like, inclusion and diversity and how do you talk about Black people, which, you know, I think all those things are interesting and important qualities. And from my friends that have been poor forever, that, you know, probably been broke since plantation days, a lot of us, the analysis seems to be centered on economic policy. And I wonder why and how, and obviously these things are not absolutes, right? There are Black middle class and Black wealthy people who are fucking Marxist materialists, right? That are really concerned with, like, the ways in which, how does my material world change, right? Like, how are you changing the structures that co-create the world that I live in, right? The conditions of my Black life and my Black death. And there are black poor folks that are like, oh, Kamala, I like her name, she black. You know, it is what it is, but I'm wondering if like this general trend that I'm seeing is self-selection for my friendship group, or is it possibly that black poor people's relationship to the permanence of blackness is different, right? Like, if there is racial equality tomorrow and you still live in the hood, what does that do for you? Or is the analysis and is the sentiment that racial equality is never going to happen, so give me my money, right? Is there a type of like black pessimism? And I'm not saying that to relate or harken back to Afro-pessimism, but is there a certain like black pessimism that exists in black poor communities, particularly those of us that have been poor from the womb to the tomb and probably will be poor from the womb to the tomb? Is there this pessimism that I think is really a black realism that regardless of how people want to talk about equality and inclusion and all these other things, that doesn't matter at the end of the day if my money ain't right? I'm wondering if that is what the difference is. And I mean, this is skepticism. I'm a skeptic anyway, so I don't really know. And this is all shit that I'm guessing about, just reading the tea leaves of what I'm seeing on Twitter and Facebook. So the question again is like, how do we go about those of us that do engage in voting, whether you believe in candidates or whether you see it as a harm reduction policy, how do you go about choosing a candidate? And maybe like that's the question itself, right? Maybe if you think about voting as harm reduction, you choose the person who you can most control or exert the most influence over, and is closest to where you are. Or if you really believe in this aspirational shit, you just say, hey, this I hope and I believe, and this is democracy, and I'm going to put my vote where it goes. Jeremy Lamar says, is there racial equality without economic equality? Maybe I'm not the right person to ask this, maybe because I'm politically, intellectually, I'm what they call a racial realist. And I'm very much like Derek Bell. I don't think that in America you can have racial equality. I think that democracy inherently, particularly a racial democracy like our own that comes from the conditions of slavery and Native and Black genocide, inherent to the understanding of what a human is race and racism and these different hierarchies. So I don't know that racial equality is actually like a thing, but I think it's something people should aspire to. But can you have racial equality without economic equality? I mean, I think they co-form each other. I think black people are poor because they're black. I think black people in America are poor due to the afterlives of slavery and the systems that live through those afterlives and continue to create the worlds in which we live in, right? Black people remain poor because of the ways in which we're seen as illegible witnesses when we're arrested or stopped by the police. We're always already seen as furtive and criminal, right? Black people are poor because we don't get the job interview because of the ways in which our names sound and because our education systems, the schools that are in our community are not really schools of education, but as Lauryn Hill would say, they're schools of miseducation, right? So like these things are all predicated on race and our understandings of race and anti-blackness. So I don't know. Well, I do know that these two things co-form each other. So to answer your question, if there is a such thing as equality, no, you can't have one without the other. But I also don't know of any country that is racially mixed that has equality. The question from Kalima is, do you think it's a more Afro-pessimism in terms of racial equality? The way you put it, we're not... Yes, okay. The way you put it, we're not going to have racial equality, so give me my money. Okay, yeah, it sounds a lot like Booker T versus Du Bois. Do you think it's a different sentiment? So she's asking, when I'm positing what racial realism in this kind of Derek Bell theory, am I engaging in this kind of like Booker T Washington conversation, like Booker T versus Du Bois? If you guys aren't familiar with Booker T Washington, he was essentially saying and arguing with W.E.B. Du Bois, that black self-sufficiency, this idea that, you know, we should have skills and trade and the ability to create our own wealth, we can be separate, We don't need to be necessarily integratedly equal. We can be separate but equal in our own space. Let's just get what we have and take care of that type of business. Du Bois was a small R Republican, so he believed in this idea of the Republican democracy. And he thought the best way to do this is to educate up the class and teach them in the arts and the sciences and raise up this talented tent that would lead the race into inclusion, to raise them up from these spots of despotism, as perhaps he would say. And so I don't think that's the same conversation. I do think there's echoes of it, because I think that's the genealogy of a lot of where most Black thought comes from, along those fault lines. But this is a more Derrick Bell conversation that essentially says that the Constitution itself is a slavery document and an afterlife of slavery. So the notions of equality that we have as Black people is not the same notion of equality that's possible through the Constitution that we have, right? Power doesn't flow in the ways in which that would allow this racial minority to be constituted as human and then to be constituted as equal, if that makes any sense. And so I do think, right, that perhaps Washington had a point in saying that you should focus on building up your own wealth and yada, yada, yada. I think that's interesting. I don't know how practical it is, but I'm always hopeful for Black people being able to self-sustain themselves in particular with particular ways, you know, our own arts, our own money, yada, yada, yada. And not to say that we're out here trying to make Black billionaires, but that instead we're trying to make sure that Black people are able to have the lives that they want. But that isn't in contrast to Du Bois's point about being able to be educated and know shit. Like, Black people have always been educated until, you know, well, except for when it's been illegal for us. And even then, we've made a way to educate ourselves with our Black schools and after schools and on the plantation. A second question. A lot of people see health in every capacity as the benchmark for wealth. So your health is your wealth, I hear that. When the candidates debated with Nasty Trump, he touched on the, what did you say, autism crisis and had a plan when New Jersey candidates didn't. New Jersey has the highest autism rates. Okay, I think that's really interesting, and I do believe that your health is your wealth. I mean, I keep using the phrase afterlives of slavery, which comes from the great Sadia Hartman, and I don't have the exact quote, and I'm actually, let me find it real quick. I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but she talks about the afterlives of slavery, including the shortened lifespan of Black people, right? Here we go. Yes, I think this is it. Okay, I'll find it in a second. But anyway, so she talks about the afterlives of slavery as being not only, you know, this kind of idea that Black people are still constrained by anti-Blackness and racism, but the effects of this, the afterlives of slavery, also include shortened life chances, these chronic health issues, the fact that, like, the weather itself, as Christina Sharp would say, is anti-Black, and not just kind of like in this theoretical sense, but oftentimes the ways and the places that Black people are forced to live in, right, are actually killing us. Like the climate itself, the places that we are have dirty water, like Flint, right? Or there's high pollution that has nothing to do with us. Or they're waste and dumping lands, right? Or we can't afford health insurance, let alone health care. Or we live in health deserts. So I think that's really, really important. I think that's why the conversation around single-payer health care is really, really telling. And this is also why I'm skeptical of people like Amy Klobuchar, who likes to say, you know, well, I would love to have single-payer health care. I'd love to have free four-year college, but we can't afford it. Who can afford it, right? Like, who's, because we know that which individuals can't afford to actually go to college. But when you say we as society can't afford it, you're saying we as society cannot afford to invest in these particular types of poor people, right? So like this kind of moderate realist pragmatist approach is really interesting, because what that often means is there's a budget that's set up. And Black people, Black poor people, white poor people as well, particularly Black queer poor people, are not seen as affordable. Like, we can't afford to engage in the humanization of these people or the welcoming of them into the American polity. political process, right, into these long lifespans, into an actually healthy and wholesome life, into a life that's economically stable. That is not where our economic priorities are as a country, yet our military budget is beyond out of control. So I think it's really telling about who we invest in and what's seen as affordable. I mean, it's clear that Amazon and Netflix paid no federal taxes this year, right? How can we afford two of the biggest companies in the world not to pay any taxes? But we can't afford healthcare or education for the poorest among us, which Black people are disproportionately poor, right? And that's really telling, knowing that, like, 400 years of unpaid labor, like, and then labor after that that's underpaid, right? And labor that's underpaid that you're also having to endure racial sexual terror just to give a profit to this country, right? Just to be taxed. So there's a lot going on there. There's a whole lot going on there. Jamila has a question. This is the politic. This is the real life language politicians I worked with told me. This is why I'm angrier and further removed from that establishment. They use words about the most marginalized as risky, or our needs are not practical. Yes, and that is so telling. Like, can we really get to the meat and the heart of that? That, like, your livelihood is not practical. Like, we can't afford to make sure you live. Someone mentioned equality, and equality is really, like, equal opportunity, which is interesting. But, like, what we're really trying to think about here is equity. And equity, Black equity, is not affordable in an anti-Black nation, right? And anti-Blackness itself is not undone, as Cory Booker would have us to believe, with love and hope. Love's a beautiful thing. You know, a lot of racist white men have fallen in love with Black women, or what they would call love, what they know to be love, right? But that doesn't end anti-Blackness. What ends anti-Blackness is a structural reforming that results in equity, and sees equity not as something aspirational, but something as necessary to the fabric of the nation. Right? Problem with that is, we live in a racial democracy where Black people are now less than 11%. So how do you get there? What does that look like? Do you accept the nation as permanently fucking you, for lack of better terms, without loop? Without consent, really. And sorry if that's triggering, but this is the reality of Black life, right? Or do you kind of keep spinning your wheels and trying to, like, birth something new, as, like, Black people have always been able to do? You know? I'm not quite sure. But I'm going to get out of here. I just wanted to try and see what this type of medium would look like. And I think we're going to do this more often, after I figure out how to not to have my iPad sideways so I can actually read your comments. But this is Black Queer Left Podcast. Thanks for checking it out. The links will be on the Facebook page. You can get this podcast anywhere you listen to your podcast: iTunes, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Google, all of the places. Also, if you want to donate to the podcast, the Simplecast website has a swipe link there. You can also find blackqueerflow@gmail.com. For PayPal. Have a good night, y'all. We're gonna have some more conversation soon. I got a dissertation to write.